Chapter 39. Often communed, but now thy goodness has unveiled to me his true nature. As the performer of thy behests, he is my friend. My heart began now to misgive me. His mournful aspect had gradually yielded place to a serene brow. A new soul appeared to actuate his frame, and his eyes to beam with preternatural luster. These symptoms did not abate, and he continued. Clara, I must not leave thee in doubt. I know not what brought about thy interview with the being whom thou callest Carwin. For a time I was guilty of thy error, and deduced from his incoherent confessions that I had been made the victim of human malice. He left us at my bidding, and I put up a prayer that my doubts should be removed. Thy eyes were shut, and thy ears sealed to the vision that answered my prayer. I was indeed deceived. The form thou hast seen was the incarnation of a demon. The visage and voice which urged me to the sacrifice of my family were his. Now he personates a human form, then he was environed with the luster of heaven. Clara, he continued, advancing closer to me, thy death must come. This minister is evil, but he from whom his commission was received is God. Submit then with all thy wonted resignation to a decree that cannot be reversed or resisted. Mark the clock. 3 minutes are allowed to thee, in which to call up thy fortitude, and prepare thee for thy doom. There he stopped. Even now, when this scene exists only in memory, when life and all its functions have sunk into torpor, my pulse throbs, and my hairs uprise, my brows are knit, as then, and I gaze around me in distraction. I was unconquerably averse to death, but death, imminent and full of agony as that which was threatened, was nothing. This was not the only, or chief inspirer of my fears. For him, not for myself, was my soul tormented. I might die, and no crime, surpassing the reach of mercy, would pursue me to the presence of my judge. But my assassin would survive to contemplate his deed, and that assassin was Wieland. Wings to bear me beyond his reach I had not. I could not vanish with a thought. The door was open, but my murderer was interposed between that and me. Of self-defense I was incapable. The frenzy that lately prompted me to blood was gone. My state was desperate. My rescue was impossible. The weight of these accumulated thoughts could not be borne. My sight became confused. My limbs were seized with convulsion. I spoke, but my words were half-formed. Spare me, my brother. Look down, righteous judge. Snatch me from this fate. Take away this fury from him, or turn it elsewhere. Such was the agony of my thoughts, that I noticed not steps entering my apartment. Supplicating eyes were cast upward, but when my prayer was breathed I once more wildly gazed at the door. A form met my sight. I shuddered as if the god whom I invoked were present. It was Carwin that again intruded, and who stood before me, erect in attitude and steadfast in look. The sight of him awakened new and rapid thoughts. His recent tale was remembered. His magical transitions and mysterious energy of voice. Whether he were infernal, or miraculous or human, there was no power, and no need to decide. Whether the contriver or not of this spell, he was able to unbind it, and to check the fury of my brother. He had ascribed to himself intentions not malignant. Here now was afforded a test of his truth. Let him interpose, as from above, revoke the savage decree which the madness of Wieland has assigned to heaven, and extinguish forever this passion for blood. My mind detected at a glance this avenue to safety. The recommendations it possessed thronged as it were together, and made but one impression on my intellect. Remoter effects and collateral dangers I saw not. Perhaps the pause of an instant had sufficed to call them up. The improbability that the influence which governed weal, and was external or human, the tendency of this stratagem to sanction so fatal an error, or substitute a more destructive rage in place of this, the insufficiency of Carwin's mere muscular forces to counteract the efforts, and restrain the fury of Wieland, might, at a second glance, have been discovered. But no second glance was allowed. My first thought hurried me to action, and, fixing my eyes upon Carwin, I exclaimed, O wretch! Once more hast thou come? Let it be, to abjure thy malice, to counterwork this hellish stratagem, to turn from me, and from my brother this desolating rage. Testify thy innocence or thy remorse, exert the powers which pertain to thee, whatever they be, to turn aside this ruin. Thou art the author of these horrors. What have I done to deserve thus to die? How have I merited this unrelenting persecution? I adjure thee, by that God whose voice thou hast dared to counterfeit, to save my life. Wilt thou then go? Leave me, succorless. Carwin listened to my entreaties unmoved, and turned from me. He seemed to hesitate a moment, then glided through the door. Rage and despair stifled my utterance. The interval of respite was past. The pangs reserved for me by Wieland were not to be endured. My thoughts rushed again into anarchy. Having received the knife from his hand, I held it loosely and without regard. But now it seized again my attention, and I grasped it with force. He seemed to notice not the entrance or exit of Carwin. My gesture and the murderous weapon appeared to have escaped his notice. His silence was unbroken. His eye, fixed upon the clock for a time, was now withdrawn. Fury kindled in every feature. All that was human in his face gave way to an expression supernatural and tremendous. I felt my left arm within his grasp. Even now I hesitated to strike. I shrunk from his assault, but in vain. Here let me desist. Why should I rescue this event from oblivion? Why should I paint this detestable conflict? Why not terminate at once this series of horrors? Hurry to the verge of the precipice, and cast myself forever beyond remembrance and beyond hope? Still I live, with this load upon my breast, with this phantom to pursue my steps, with adders lodged in my bosom, and stinging me to madness. Still I consent to live. Yes. I will rise above the sphere of mortal passions. I will spurn at the cowardly remorse that bids me seek impunity in silence, or comfort in forgetfulness. My nerves shall be new strung to the task. Have I not resolved? I will die. The gulf before me is inevitable and near. I will die, but then only when my tale is at an end. 3. My right hand, grasping the unseen knife, was still disengaged. It was lifted to strike. All my strength was exhausted, but what was sufficient to the performance of this deed? Already was the energy awakened and the impulse given that should bear the fatal steel to his heart, when Wieland shrunk back, his H hand was withdrawn. Breathless with affright and desperation, I stood, freed from his grasp, unassailed, untouched. Thus long had the power which controlled the scene forborne to interfere. But now his might was irresistible, and Wieland in a moment was disarmed of all his purposes. A voice, louder than human organs could produce, shriller than language can depict, burst from the ceiling, and commanded him to hold. Trouble and dismay succeeded to the steadfastness that had lately been displayed in the looks of Wieland. His eyes roved from one quarter to another, with an expression of doubt. He seemed to wait for a further intimation. Carwin's agency was here easily recognized. I had besought him to interpose in my defense. He had flown. I had imagined him deaf to my prayer, and resolute to see me perish, yet he disappeared merely to devise and execute the means of my relief. Why did he not forbear when this end was accomplished? Why did his misjudging zeal and accursed precipitation overpass that limit? Or meant he thus to crown the scene, and conduct his inscrutable plots to this consummation? Such ideas were the fruit of subsequent contemplation. This moment was pregnant with fate. I had no power to reason. In the career of my tempestuous thoughts, rent in two pieces as my mind was by accumulating horrors, Carwin was unseen and unsuspected. I partook of Wieland's credulity, shook with his amazement, and panted with his awe. Silence took place for a moment, so much as allowed the attention to recover its post. Then new sounds were uttered from above. Man of errors, cease to cherish thy delusion. Not heaven or hell, but thy senses, have misled thee to commit these acts. Shake off thy frenzy, and descend into rational and human. Be lunatic no longer. My brother opened his lips to speak. His tone was terrific and faint. He muttered an appeal to heaven. It was difficult to comprehend the theme of his inquiries. They implied doubt as to the nature of the impulse that hitherto had guided him, and questioned whether he had acted in consequence of insane perceptions. To these interrogatories the voice, which now seemed to hover at his shoulder, loudly answered in the affirmative. Then uninterrupted silence ensued. Fallen from his lofty and heroic station, now finally restored to the perception of truth, weighed to earth by the recollection of his own deeds, consoled no longer by a consciousness of rectitude for the loss of offspring and wife, a loss for which he was indebted to his own misguided hand, Wieland was transformed at once into the man of sorrows. He reflected not that credit should be as reasonably denied to the last as to any former intimation, that one might as justly be ascribed to erring or diseased senses as the other. He saw not that this discovery in no degree affected the integrity of his conduct, that his motives had lost none of their claims to the homage of mankind, that the preference of supreme good and the boundless energy of duty were undiminished in his bosom. It is not for me to pursue him through the ghastly changes of his countenance. Words he had none. Now he sat upon the floor, motionless in all his limbs, with his eyes glazed and fixed, a monument of woe. Anon a spirit of tempestuous, but undesigning activity seized him. He rose from his place, and strode across the floor, tottering and at random. His eyes were without moisture, and gleamed with the fire that consumed his vitals. The muscles of his face were agitated by convulsions. His lips moved, but no sound escaped him. That nature should long sustain this conflict was not to be believed. My state was little different from that of my brother. I entered, as it were, into his thoughts. My heart was visited and rent by his pangs. H, that thy frenzy had never been cured. That thy madness, with its blissful visions, would return, or, if that must not be, that thy scene would hasten to a close. That death would cover thee with his oblivion. What can I wish for thee? Thou who hast vied with the great preacher of thy faith in sanctity of motives, and in elevation above sensual and selfish. Thou whom thy fate has changed into parasite and savage. Can I wish for the continuance of thy being? No. For a time his movements seemed destitute of purpose. If he walked, if he turned, if his fingers were entwined with each other, if his hands were pressed against opposite sides of his head with a force sufficient to crush it into pieces, it was to tear his mind from self-contemplation, to waste his thoughts on external objects. Speedily this train was broken. A beam appeared to be darted into his mind which gave a purpose to his efforts. An avenue to escape presented itself, and now he eagerly gazed about him. When my thoughts became engaged by his demeanor, my fingers were stretched, as by a mechanical force, and the knife, no longer heated or of use, escaped from my grasp, and fell unperceived on the floor. His eye now lighted upon it. He seized it with the quickness of thought. I shrieked aloud, but it was too late. He plunged it to the hilt in his neck, and his life instantly escaped with the stream that gushed from the wound. He was stretched at my feet, and my hands were sprinkled with his blood as he fell. Such was thy last deed, my brother. For a spectacle like this was it my fate to be reserved. Thy eyes were closed, thy face ghastly with death, thy arms, and the spot where thou liest, floated in thy life's blood. These images have not for a moment forsaken me. Till I am breathless and cold, they must continue to hover in my sight. Carwin, as I said, had left the room, but he still lingered in the house. My voice summoned him to my aid, but I scarcely noticed his re-entrance, and now faintly recollect his terrified looks, his broken exclamations, his vehement avowals of innocence, the effusions of his pity for me, and his offers of assistance. I did not listen, I answered him not, I ceased to upbraid or accuse. His guilt was a point to which I was indifferent. Ruffian or devil, black as hell or bright as angels, thenceforth he was nothing to me. I was incapable of sparing a look or a thought from the ruin that was spread at my feet. When he left me, I was scarcely conscious of any variation in the scene. He informed the inhabitants of the hut of what had passed, and they flew to the spot. Careless of his own safety, he hasted to the city to inform my friends of my condition. My uncle speedily arrived at the house. The body of Wheel, and was removed from my presence, and they supposed that I would follow it. But no, my home is ascertained. Here I have taken up my rest, and never will I go hence, till, like Wieland, I am borne to my grave. Importunity was tried in vain. They threatened to remove me by violence, nay, violence was used. But my soul prizes too dearly this little roof, to endure to be bereaved of it. Force should not prevail when the hoary locks and supplicating tears of my uncle were ineffectual. My repugnance to move gave birth to ferociousness and frenzy when force was employed, and they were obliged to consent to my return. They besought me, they remonstrated, they appealed to every duty that connected me with him that made me, and with my fellow men in vain. While I live I will not go hence. Have I not fulfilled my destiny? Why will ye torment me with your reasonings and reproofs? Can ye restore to me the hope of my better days? Can ye give me back Catherine and her babes? Can ye recall to life him who died at my feet? I will eat, I will drink, I will lie down, and rise up at your bidding. All I ask is the choice of my abode. What is there unreasonable in this demand? Shortly will I be at peace. This is the spot which I have chosen in which to breathe my last sigh. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.